I'm now recording, and this is Karen Brewster, and today is December 14th, 2018, here with Kathleen Mike Dalton at her home in Fairbanks, Alaska, and her daughter Libby Dalton is also here with us, as is the dog Izzy, who
Isabel,
who might make a
Chesapeake Retriever.
Right. Who might make a sound appearance at some point. So, Mike, two weeks ago, we were talking about RS-2477, uh-huh. Historic Trails and Navigable Waters. And I just had a couple follow-up questions. If we can start with that, and then we'll...
Okay.
So, my question is, what is the connection between those historic trails and the navigable waters?
Well, they're both part of the Lands Act that was passed in 1980.
The Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There are sections of that.
But they're two separate issues that have to get resolved in terms of land use?
The lands, the Native Claims Act was passed when in 70, 71.
Mm-hmm.
Had several sections in there that were anathema to miners and trappers and cross-country skiers and motorists. The first one that impacted Alaska was, I don't know what section it was, but it was a section of the Lands Act that guaranteed that anyone who had mining claims, mining operation, and the classic example was Kantishna.
Mm-hmm.
And that act put the miners in Kantishna out of business overnight. So the hate for the Park Service grew pretty fast. Because it just took the livelihood and the estate, the value of the estate that some people may have, it was all, may have been tied up in their mining equipment, their mining lands, just wiped them out. So when you get your life estate dissolved by the Park Service, it's not fun.
No.
Put a lot of business, miners out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what section of that Lands Act or the Native Claims Act, but the Park Service went into the back door to Kantishna, which was what's that road they go?
Stampede Trail.
Stampede Trail.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very prominent miner in Alaska named Earl Pilgrim. And when he died, he had discovered platinum in Alaska, and he had discovered lots of gold. He prospected and mined lots of gold. When he died, he willed his estate to the University of Alaska School of Mines, because he had a mill on the Savage River or Kantishna River. I'm not sure which it was, but it was in there. And it was left to the School of Mines to be used as a working mill. The Park Service went in there when, and all the miners who'd gone to school up here knew about it. And it was left as he had left it when he turned the electricity off.
Mm-hmm.
Park Service went in there one weekend, put some dynamite under it, and blew it to smithereens. With no prior contact with the university or prior contact with the miners, no negotiations with anybody. just arrogantly went in there and blew it to smithereens. Well, that enraged some of the miners who were already enraged even more.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible. That's how they acted. Mm-hmm. Very arrogant.
And did the Park Service believe it was on Park Service land? Is that why they blew it up?
They were claiming that they owned it.
Yeah.
Those are two examples.
Okay.
Another example was over the 40 mile, closer to the Yukon River, in that area.
Mm-hmm.
They used the RS-2477 section of the 72 mining law to put miners out of business. I mean, they just went in there and ran them off.
And how does that work? What is it in RS-2477 that...
Because they would use an old declared access to some mining property that they should have been able to use because of its historic nature. Park Service would say, no, you can't go in there, can't use that. They go in there and run them off. So those are three examples.
So the miners felt it was an old trail that had that had a history of use, so they used it.
And yeah, then the government said, well, it falls under the definition of an RS-2477, so I have the legal right to go in there and use that old historic route.
Right, but the federal government
said, no, you don't.
Said, no, you don't have that right. So that's what they fight back and forth about.
Mm-hmm.
So the work you did for Lieutenant Governor Coghill when you did all that research on all those RS-2477 trails, why was that done? Why was that important to do?
Because of the examples I just gave you to establish the fact that the state of Alaska had some rights to that.
Okay.
Which we legally did.
And so... On those ones that you researched, you were able to prove that...
Yeah, prove early use.
Okay, and so that's useful if there's ever a court case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The John Sturgeon case is part of all this.
Okay.
Even, and there were others, too, other cases.
But so that's the question. Sturgeon is on the river, so that's navigable waters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that still falls in the same...
Same basic issues.
Okay.
That he has a right to use it because the state owns the navigable streams in Alaska.
Right. And then I would assume that navigable waters are also important for... isn't there something about surface and subsurface and who has rights in navigable or non-navigable waters?
Under the Statehood Act, the state of Alaska owns the riverbeds. They don't own the water, they own the high water mark on one side of the stream to the high water mark on the other side.
Right.
Navigable streams.
Yeah, so if it's navigable, then mm-hmm. the state owns it.
Navigable waters. That's just another section of that.
Right.
Native Claims Act.
But if it's a non-navigable, then the state can't claim ownership?
It can't claim the ownership.
Okay. And ownership is important for access, for
to
resources.
Go hunting.
Yeah.
Go from one side of the river to the other. Go berry picking.
Okay.
Go to moose camp in the... fall.
Well, and also I think it would be important for resources.
It's important for canoes and kayaks, stern wheelers, motorized boats.
And I think all that access is important for recreation, as you say.
And snow machines and four wheelers.
It's also important for access to resources like mining or
of course,
oil
yeah.
and things like that. So the state mm-hmm. is interested in having that kind of access.
John Sturgeon case now is on its third appeal, Well, I think it's back in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals now.
I don't know. I can't keep track of it.
No.
Headed back.
It's at the Supreme, isn't it?
They argued it in November. It's under
advisement. It's been before the Supreme Court twice.
Ruby says it's back at the Supreme.
Back at Ninth Circuit.
No, at Supreme.
Did it go back to Supreme?
Yep. Oh. It's been argued. They're waiting for a decision.
Oh, okay. That's right.
That's right. Yeah. So, okay. Well, that answers my...
And some people in town who are real knowledgeable on that are Craig Compo.
Yeah.
The Compos. So if you want to do a little sidebar story or something, see him.
Yeah, I don't really want to get into the Sturgeon case. It's very complicated. And
yeah, it
I
is.
I think you need to be a lawyer to understand all that stuff. But what you explained about the importance of navigable waters and RS-2477 and
well, the people in Rampart are... illegal if they go from Rampart down to their fish camp.
Why is that?
If they're if the Park Service had anything to do with it, because they still say they own the waterway. But until these issues are tested in court, Park Service, like in the Sturgeon case, Park Service went in there and pointed a shotgun at him.
Yeah.
You don't like shotguns. They kill people.
Yeah.
Or the people carrying them kill people.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's very helpful. Thank you for explaining that. I just wanted to clarify that from our other discussion.
Park Service has got too big for its britches. In that case. Mm-hmm. If it hadn't been to the Supreme Court and wasn't in litigation now, Park Service would still go over there to Rampart, stop some poor old native paddling up the river to his moose camp and say, you can't come here.
Yeah, well, I know it.
They're intimidating. They go talk to, like that 70-some-year-old man from Circle was going to moose hunting. Can't think of his name now. I think it was Fry. F-R-Y-E, something like that. Going moose hunting with his wife and another man who was in his 70s. And they went out there in the middle of the river and pointed shotguns at those two old men and that woman and said, beat your craft. And they wouldn't do it. And they finally forced them to do it.
Well, also, was it the 70s or 80s, there was the whole conflict with Yukon Charlie and people having cabins and
living
off the land.
Pretty much the same thing as Sturgeon. Yeah. It's all basically the same issue.
Everybody's fighting over whether it's an allotment or on land or whether it's...
Well, if it's an allotment, that's pretty clear because they can go to court and determine the allotment because it gives them 160 acres and they like that because they put a fence up... shoot anybody come on their private property because it's their private property.
Yeah.
Now, the allotments are one of the clear issues.
Well, you still have to prove up on an allotment that you've had.
Yeah, there's certain requirements that you in order to. Well, there's some who come and say, "Well, my grandfather had a fish camp here; it's not mine now." Well, how do you know it's yours? Well, it was my grandfather's. He said I could have it.
Yeah.
Well, you have to go to court and say more than that to prove ownership.
Yeah, there's a whole process for that. Mm-hmm.
And they can get pretty aggressive. Don't let anybody on their land. And a lot of the native corporations put no hunting, no trespassing signs up.
Unless you're a member of the corporation.
Yeah, well, they put up their own rules, the corporations too.
Yeah. I'm just going to pause. Okay. Last time we were talking about when you worked at the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, and Libby brought up the good question about your reporting on the oil discovery at Prudhoe Bay, that was a story you worked on.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking that might be a good place to start with more News Miner stories.
Well, there were signs of oil up there for centuries. And Cole, we're reading in your Harry Brower book how that early Navy came up there to Point Lay.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles Brower, didn't he come there first in 1886?
I think we said 1886, yeah.
Well, they knew there was coal resources. One of the largest coal resource in the United States is on the North Slope.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a coal mine at Atkasuk.
Yeah, on the Mead River.
On the Mead River,
and
yeah.
The Eskimos at Barrow had been using that.
And then there were also oil seeps at Cape Simpson.
Yeah, so there were known coal provinces and a lot of oil seeps that people knew about.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the people who knew about it were USGS. And in the early teens, USGS sent exploratory crews up here.
Mm-hmm.
Who went out and hired people like Harry Brower to show them where the coal was and where the oil seeps were. But the early whalers knew about it. You know, a lot of people knew about those resources. So, World War II came along and the Navy was looking ahead for supplies for future sources of oil for their ships. They had sources in Texas and Pennsylvania and North Dakota. Can't think of the other oil provinces in the United States right now. But
Teapot Dome, was that North Dakota?
That was a petroleum reserve, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was North Dakota. I can't remember.
I think it was in Wyoming.
Oh, Wyoming. Maybe.
I don't know. I have to look that up.
One of those places,
but
yeah.
In 1923, President Harding set aside 4 petroleum reserves. Teapot Dome was one. And then there were 3 others, one of which was in the Alaska Arctic. They knew a lot about it because the USGS had been up here exploring summer field parties.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing surface mapping. And then there were later evidences reported. You know, the Presbyterian Church was early and along the coast. And there were other explorers that came in that, who were not necessarily government. But the Episcopal Church, for example, did a lot of exploring in Alaska just because they were there to save the heathens.
Yeah, yeah, they were missionizing.
And then the Assembly of God Church moved in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they had the resources. Well, the Catholic missionaries were up in the Arctic too. When I went up there, there was one priest who served all the North Slope and the West Coast.
Hmm.
He was Father Tom Cunningham.
Oh, I've heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
So he was Catholic, huh?
Yes. So people like that were up in, on their own missions and could report things like the seepages along Colville, seeping out of the banks,
mm-hmm.
and up at Simpson, and the vast coal resources. So naturally the Navy, like back in the late 19th century, heard about the coal, but the Navy was not using coal for anymore, but they'd heard about the oil, so that was the year that President Harding came to Alaska. That was the year he died. Mm-hmm. I told you about his trip to Fairbanks. No. Brian, I think I did in an early interview about the ladies in town who forced the mayor to marry his girlfriend, because they were not going to allow him to greet the President of the United States when he was still shacked up with one of the prostitutes. So they made Father Tom, or Mayor Tom Markham, marry his girlfriend. So that's when Harding came up. Uh-huh. And that's when Harding died on his way back to Washington.
Yeah.
In San Francisco, I think.
Yeah.
It was a big deal in Alaska.
Yeah, it's not so often the president comes to Alaska.
Not very often.
No.
The President Eisenhower had been up here in the 40s, 1940s.
We have pictures of him. Mm-hmm. Lots of nuts up there.
Yeah. Huh.
Right over there.
Or 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, show her that, would you? Can you find it?
I'll get him out.
So
we have a picture of President Eisenhower.
When he came.
And President Ford was here in 1975.
Yeah, and I know Reagan was here with the Pope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was 1980, I think.
84.
Yeah.
And then others like John Kennedy and Johnson and probably Nixon were here on fuel stopovers.
Yeah.
On their way to Tokyo or China.
Yeah. So how did you end up doing the story about oil discovery at Prudhoe?
Oh, I've never written a story about it. It's just when I worked for the News Miner, the oil companies put it on the map, mm-hmm. and in the news, because they'd been up there.
They'd been exploring for a while.
They'd been up north and doing electronic exploration, getting readings on subsurface rocks, which is important to them. In those days, that told them what was underneath there, what kind of rocks.
Yeah.
Some rocks contain oil, some rocks don't. So there was a lot of activity on that because they knew there was oil up there. And Atlantic Richfield was pretty consistent in their efforts. And so they were spending lots of money to fly in there. Of course, there's no place to land when they first went up there. In the wintertime, they created their own airstrips on the frozen lakes. And then every once in a while, you'd see a great big cargo plane land at the airport, and people say, gee, I wonder what they're doing. Somebody must be doing something somewhere. So we knew that a lot of activity was occurring, and they were using Fairbanks as a supply base. So in the 60s, they were doing a lot of exploratory work up there. You might go to the airport and see two or three private Lear jets parked out there, some oil executives flying in and out. So we started putting our stories together. Now, what are you doing here? Oh, I'm headed to Prudhoe. What are you doing at Prudhoe? Oh, we're exploring for oil.
Yeah, I was going to say that were the oil companies public about what they were doing?
No.
So how did you find out?
We'll just sit next to some guy in a bar and listen to the talk. In the construction business, you know, there are all kinds of different people. There are dishwashers and boat cooks who make the beds and sweep the floors, and some who are executives. And, you know, they make friends in town. You hear about this and that.
And it was a small town back then, so
mm-hmm.
you would notice this.
So then the state put together a cat train to go up to help supply. They wanted to build a road, but they couldn't. There were too many roadblocks, illegal roadblocks. So this was in the 60s. In 1968, most of the activities started stirring up. There was one fellow named Tennessee Miller who kind of pushed the state along. He had cat train equipment and knew what he was doing. So he ran several cat trains up to Prudhoe Bay from interior from here, or closer to Nenana. They take off from Nenana area. And the union guys didn't like him, so they go every once in a while to his big compound down South Fairbanks and burn up all of his equipment. I mean, they destroy tractors, trailers, ATCO units, whatever they could set a torch to. He did that several times, but he never gave up. So I guess some people in the state finally decided, meaning people in the state, I'm talking about Wally Hickel now, he had vision of doing that himself. He would have liked to have been on the lead cat. he was very interested in overland transportation. So finally the state kind of got shamed into providing or putting together their own cat train. In 68, March of 68, ARCO, Atlantic Richfield, announced its discovery. And that kind of brought a few people together. Mm-hmm. They had some public relation trips up there. I went on the first trip that the governor made up there. That was in 1968. He and his land experts had already, well, not under Governor Hickel, but under Governor Egan, he had some very far-sighted people in his administration. People like Harold Strandberg, Roscoe Bell, who headed up some of the departments.
And that was in Egan's administration?
Egan administration selected the lands up there.
Okay.
The lands that the state was going to claim.
Okay.
So then in 66, Governor Hickel was elected. Governor Egan stepped aside for 4 years.
And the Hickel Highway was Governor Hickel's attempt to get a road?
That was his muddy trail up to the Arctic. That was a derogatory term that the construction workers used. The Hickel Highway.
Right.
It was a bumpy road.
But yeah, that was an attempt to build a road up there, right? Instead of relying on the winter cat trains, they were hoping to have a year-round road.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Before the Hall Road was built.
He pushed the issue.
Yeah.
For several years.
Mm-hmm. And was did he push it because he wanted to be able to get that oil out?
He wanted to open up the oil prospects. The state had a lot of land.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1969, they proved it by having an oil lease sale, which brought in $900 million.
Wow.
I bid on one of those selections.
Did you get it?
No. A friend of mine and I put up $60,000 bid on one land that Sohio of Ohio came in and outbid us by $540,000. So, well, we knew we were out of the league. So anyway, in the mid-60s, the oil companies were bugging the state, the legislature, the governor about, you know, get some road up here. They had to fly equipment and tractors and food supplies, drilling mud, drilling pipe, on C-130 aircraft, which is pretty expensive, and they wanted to bring it in overland. So Hickel got pushed on that. Of course, they didn't have to push very hard with him. So they created their own cat train in the spring of 68 and headed to Prudhoe Bay. And they proved that they could build an ice road to Prudhoe, so they're going to go into that. And then Izzy, breathe a little bit so I know you're still alive.
She's breathing.
What was the next move there?
Well, you mentioned going on one of those PR trips with the governor.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk about
that? In March of 68, Atlantic Richfield officially showed off its discovery well, invited anybody who could get up there. So, of course, the governor had access to a National Guard plane, which is a DC-3 or C-46. I'm not sure which one it was now. But I hitched a ride on that plane, took some pictures of the crew that went up. That got some publicity.
How did you hitch a ride? You just go out to the airport?
Well, number one, you need to talk to the pilot, he's in charge of the flight, or you talk to the governor. I can't remember how I got on that. I think we talked to the governor's office.
And you were working for the News Miner.
News Miner, yeah.
So you wrote a story about?
Oh, yeah.
So what did Prudhoe look like back then?
Looked pretty bare. They didn't have, you know, within 10 years, they had Atlantic Richfield had its home office up there, field office, which was about a three-story building. Mm-hmm. And British Petroleum did too. We call it the BP Hilton. They had a swimming pool. Of course, there was a practical reason for that, that it was instant water supply for fire, in case of fire. Same up at Barrow, you know, they got a swimming pool there.
In high school, yeah.
But they have instant water for fire purposes.
It was the BP Hilton is the one that had the
swimming pool. Mm-hmm. I think they still do. Hmm. But it was first class. I mean, the worker was high on the lists for those oil companies. They took very good care of their workers. They had double rooms. Usually they had a week on. In a lot of cases, it was a week on and a week off. So two people could occupy one suite of two beds and never see each other, because one would be here this week and then he'd go back. And they had bull cooks who came in every day and cleaned, changed the bedding and the towels.
It's like staying in a hotel.
Yeah, exactly. Then they had a huge food service. You could go in like in a hotel in the middle of the night and get a steak if you're getting off of duty.
Yeah, they had 24-hour shifts for workers, probably.
Hmm?
The workers worked three
shifts. 24 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or you could go through the buffet line and make your own sandwich. It was first class. Everything was very clean. And
when you went there in 68, did they have buildings or accommodations or bunkhouse?
They had the Discovery well,
uh-huh.
The wellhead. And the airplane we came on was sitting out in the middle of a lake, frozen. That was our landing strip.
Yeah.
They had gone out and cleaned it off. That's how ARCO and BP got in there at first.
Mm-hmm.
building their own airstrips on lakes. Then after they got their foothold up there, they started hiring construction workers and started digging holes and moving gravel and built their own airstrips.
Yeah. And then built the whole infrastructure and complex at Prudhoe with all those...
They've been building that complex since.
Yeah. With all the accommodations and the offices. And
then there were other homesteads up there. I'll call them that for lack of a better name. Like, they would go up there and build, like this Tennessee Miller I talked to you about. Mm-hmm. He had his own home base camp there. Okay. Had his own same type of accommodations, only a lot lesser in quality.
Yeah, so sort of the contractors and subcontractors.
Contractors camp.
Yeah.
Oh, you've probably seen them.
Well, no, not really.
Dead Horse, Happy Horse.
Crazy Horse.
No, you see, I don't know about those. Tell me about those.
Those are the camps of other contractors up there, or drillers, but of lesser quality than what I described.
Okay.
With ARCO and BP. They're because, the ones who are, had big-time money.
Yeah, because now you land the airstrip when you land at Dead Horse. It's the Dead Horse Airport.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know that comes from a name of a contractor camp?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Actually, it came after the name of some young university people on the ridge over here. And some other friends here in town formed a trucking business. Pretty rudimentary here in Fairbanks. They called it Dead Horse Haulers. That's where the place got its name, because some of the first trucks up there were Dead Horse Haulers.
Huh.
And some people claim they were actually a dead horse up there. It wasn't that at all. They said, well, William Ogilvy surveyed the Canadian route, the Canadian border at the 141st parallel back in 1899 or 1899, something like that. And that was one of his horses up there died. Well, that's not true.
I wonder why those guys picked Dead Horse for their hauling company.
Because they were a bunch of university guys who liked to smoke pot and goof off and have little meetings. And they're, well, what are we going to call our trucking company? Let's call it Dead Horse Haulers. You know, stuff like that happens.
And then what about Crazy Horse and Happy Horse?
Those were names... Other contractors went up there, not as big as ARCO and BP.
Right.
And they would build their base camp. They'd have a cafeteria, have rooms and showers, but they're all ATCO units usually that were kind of flimsy.
Mm-hmm.
They were not of the quality of BP and ARCO.
So Happy Horse.
So they just named it. Dead Horse got its name up there, so then they started flying off that, having fun.
Yeah, playing off that name.
Well, there was the Happy Valley.
Yeah, there's Happy Valley along the Hall Road.
So they probably got Happy Horse. They thought about Happy Valley.
Yeah. Yeah, there was one of the pipeline construction times. There was one base camp there for the state had.
At Happy Valley.
For the construction of the highway. And that was Happy Valley. And Tulik and Galbraith, and just the name of their
Franklin
site.
Franklin Bluffs.
Yeah, Sagvaniktok.
Franklin Bluffs.
Yeah, Sag-1.
Yeah, that was privately owned.
Oh, and then Attigan, there's an Attigan camp. Like, maybe it's called Galbraith Lake.
Oh, it's called Shenandoah Ship.
Attigan is right in the Brooks Range.
Yeah.
And Galbraith is...
It's just past it. Yeah.
It's the first camp you'll come to after you go over the passes and go down the other side of the brook.
Yeah.
But I think that Crazy Horse, Happy Horse, Dead Horse was just a theme.
Yeah.
So they kept it going.
Yeah. They were just having fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just having fun naming it.
Yeah. So when you went up and saw that Discovery Well number one, that was just for the day. You didn't stay over when you went with
that
the
That was
governor.
Just a day trip, yeah.
Well, that sounds pretty exciting, though, to be on one of those trips.
Well, it was. Yeah, and we have a picture of it.
Cool.
I think I was in one of the pictures somewhere along the line.
So did you realize, when you went up there, did you realize the excitement and the historicness of the event and what it meant?
And then a few days or a couple of weeks later, they had the sale. That was pretty exciting in Anchorage. It was a major event because oil companies from all over the world had bidders there. And I was there with my partner. We only had to put 10% down, so we only had to come up with $6,000.
Wow.
But it was kind of fun to be part of the action.
So there, you were part of the action as a bidder, not as a reporter?
At both.
Oh, both. So you reported on that sale?
Yeah, it was Olga Carson.
Olga Carson and you?
Yeah, we went to the oil sale. We're sitting there next to these big oil people handing out $1 million checks. We're sitting there with our $6,000 check. It was fun to be part of the action.
Yeah, it's cool.
Oh, Mike, what are you doing here today? Oh, well, we're bidding on one of the leases.
Well, you were ahead of your time. You knew that it was worth something.
Well, if we'd had $600,000 more, we could have won one of the leases.
Then you'd be a millionaire by now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now, at this point, was your husband still alive?
He was up there over on the west part of the slope. Your Umiat Gubik.
But he wasn't doing oil.
He was not involved in this at all.
No, he was doing construction engineering stuff, not oil.
For different companies, yeah. He was over closer to Umiat. He was doing exploratory stuff, mm-hmm. moving camps and plowing out winter roads. That was the poor boy side.
Mm. But very talented to know how to do all that stuff in the Arctic. That Arctic logistics is a very specialized talent.
Yeah.
For sure.
That's why he was so valuable.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of interesting to see these guys from Wall Street and Saudi Arabia and coming up to get a little piece of the action.
So then you probably wrote a lot of stories along the way about pipeline and all that.
I did.
And did you have to keep hitching rides up there?
That's the only way to get there. There's no scheduled air service. BP and ARCO finally bit the bullet early. They realized there was no basic service like that. So they provided their own. They needed a crew change. They'd fly people out, fly people up. Because it couldn't. Wien Airlines started going in there using their strips. Mutual arrangement, you know. So, yeah, I did a lot of pre-discovery and post-discovery. Just as things came along in late 68, after the discovery, I hitched a ride up to the States Cat train, which was up near Anaktuvik. I flew into Anaktuvik, and Tennessee Miller and his crew were already there, beat the state.
So did you ride on one of those cat trains?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I got to Anaktuvik. I went knocking on doors to see if I could find somebody to take me down the John River to the States Cat Train. That's when I hired Jack Ogook.
Mm-hmm.
And he delivered me a snowbank.
And now, was that by dog team or snow machine?
Snow machine.
Okay.
He probably had one of the first snow machines in Anaktuvik.
Yeah, 1968, that's pretty early for mm-hmm. snow machines. Yeah, but what was Anaktuvik like in 1968?
Pretty much like it was in 1958. No sod houses. They didn't have an airstrip yet. Well, they had frozen lakes or streams they could plow out.
Mm-hmm. So when you flew up there, you landed on the lake?
I think we landed on the John River.
Okay.
It starts up there at Anaktuvik, mm-hmm. comes down. So anyway, he gave me a snow machine ride back down the south slope, met the train, and I rode for about 4 days with the cat train. Became the assistant cook.
And you were, I would assume, the only woman on that cat train.
Oh, yeah. I was the only woman on any of those trips up there. So, I didn't have a travel advisor. Just had to hitch your ride. Hope you can find a place to land. I always took a big duffel bag. It had a mummy bag in it and extra clothes and plenty of winter gear. Because you could always find somebody's floor to sleep on and take some extra food or so. I've been doing that for a long time because when you go into villages on a story or a visit, you just take some food with you, mm-hmm. put it on the kitchen table.
Yep.
So I would do that. I'd always take some food supplies.
Right.
If they wanted them, they could have them. If they didn't, they didn't.
So one of the interviews, we were looking at pictures of some of those early cat trains with the different parts of the cat train.
Mm-hmm.
So on that one from the John River, did you have to share a bunkhouse with the guys, or what did they do with you?
Well, the cook had his own bunk. He ran the cook shack, and they had a small water gun for him. Was the only one who had his private house. And he worked mostly nights. So he let me use his bunk. Because he was up most of the time at night. You had to work it out, usually on the spot.
But they were willing to let you come along.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You'd think back, they'd go, oh, we don't want a woman there.
Well, I knew most of the guys. Then worked for my husband and run cat trains for him, or somehow or other knew us already.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you strike me like you would have been tough and able to handle it, and they knew that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You didn't come out there in your...
Well, they knew who Jim Dalton's wife was.
Yeah.
I'd met a lot of them before up at Barrow. Most of them were retreads, you know.
Yeah.
Recycled cat trainers.
Yeah.
From the Barrow days.
Yeah.
Nice guys. Most construction guys are real decent people.
Mm-hmm.
They have to get along with each other. They're in very, very confined... stressful situations.
Mm-hmm.
So they just learned to put up with it.
What did you do for bathroom facilities?
Snowbank. Same as guys.
Yeah. You had your own private snowbank?
No, I'm not plenty up there. I didn't take my own.
Well, I was saying, they knew you were tough. You didn't show up in your skirt
and high-heeled shoes. I didn't demand special services at all. And they knew that.
So what did you come back with after those 4 days?
If I were lucky, I'd catch a plane back. They always had small aircraft flying up with emergency supplies for the drill rig or emergency supplies for the kitchen or Caterpillar parts.
So where did you get to in those 4 days? Did you get all the way to Prudhoe?
No. Just got up to Anaktuvuk.
From John River to Anaktuvuk?
They were downriver on this side of the brooks. So they moseyed on up to Anaktuvuk and I left.
Okay.
Some bush plane. Because when you, in those days, any airplane going north had a load. Coming south, usually had an empty seat.
Yeah.
Or wait space.
Yeah.
So I hitched a ride in an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I had a pretty good working relations with the Department of Transportation.
You have to.
You have to, yeah.
Sounds like, yeah, you knew all the pilots probably.
No, I knew the organizer of their airlift.
Yeah.
We just had a working agreement. Because he told me one day, he says, anytime you want a ride south, just come on and let me know. Because we usually first send in a transmission up there for a truck or a tractor. You know, they're way more than you do. And we always have space coming south. Wait space.
Who do you remember who that guy was?
Yeah, his name was Bruce Campbell. Later, there was a commissioner named Bruce Campbell, but it was not that Bruce Campbell. There were two Bruce Campbells.
So this Bruce Campbell, did he work for state DOT?
DOT.
Okay, it wasn't the oil companies.
No, state.
The state was doing all that.
I never did hitch a ride with oil companies. They just wouldn't get into agreements like that because they had so much at stake. People are always looking for somebody to sue.
Yeah, they didn't want to take pocket.
They didn't work like that.
They didn't want the liability of you.
No liability.
Yeah.
So no, I never even tried. Because I knew that I knew most of them. I knew they'd say no.
Yeah. That makes sense. Now I was thinking about the 4 days on the cat drain, what your impressions were and what kind of the story you wrote when you came back.
Can't remember. My impressions, well, I knew some of the guys, you know, so it was nice to have somebody there I knew, and they knew me, so we had some pretty good gab sessions. They were happy to see somebody like me.
Yeah. They were tired of looking at the same old guys every day.
So retreads?
Retreads. How many guys were on that cat train? Do you remember?
I don't know. I guess 20.
Oh, that's a lot
probably
of people.
Probably 20.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of their names?
Yeah. Anderson, Linda's father.
Oh.
And Walter Kopp.
Bud Anderson.
Walter Kopp.
K-O-P-P.
Okay.
He was later Grand President of Pioneers. Mm. And
who were the mechanics? Did you know the mechanics?
I don't remember. They were just construction workers, came in for coffee or a meal.
Who was the cook?
His name was Miller. I can't remember his first name. But he'd been a cook in the interior for a long time, worked in mining camps. They picked up all their employees from local people.
Well, at that time, there were lots of guys like that who knew.
Lots of guys looking for jobs.
And they knew how to do construction.
And they knew how, yeah.
Mechanic or operators.
That's why when the Dew Line started, my husband was put in charge of this western sector. He was able to just go pick them out or get on the phone and call a couple of people, and they put together some crews.
Right. Any other names you remember from that cat train?
Yeah, Bud Anderson.
You said Bud, Walter Kopp.
Walter Kopp.
Anyone else?
Miller.
Yeah.
Cook Miller. I don't remember the any others.
Mm-hmm. So what did they do for entertainment?
Nothing.
They
had no entertainment.
Did they just keep moving 24/7?
Work 24/7. They play cribbage, things like that.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, if they'd take a day off, they'd maybe play some poker.
Did they have troubles with breakdowns or getting things stuck? Because they were breaking trail as they went.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they had a lot of problems. They had to repair tractors on the way and other equipment. They always made sure the kitchen equipment worked.
So were there any breakdowns while you were with them?
Mm-mm. No, they were pretty quiet when I was there. We just stayed in one spot for a couple days. I don't know why they stopped there that long.
Okay. Any other things about oil? I guess the building of the pipeline and the road.
Yeah, that started in, 74? Maybe?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that was altogether a different atmosphere. Frenzied atmosphere. Once the CAT train got up to Sag 1 and Pluto, then others could follow it.
Mm-hmm.
And activity picked up miserably. And when they started the road, they built a road, and then the next day the trucks could drive another mile or two or three or four or ten. Once they got some road built, the trucks really started moving right away. Loaded mostly with 48-inch pipeline pipe or smaller diameter drilling pipe and drilling mud and other supplies they needed.
So they first built infrastructure at Dead Horse and Pluto with that CAT train and airplanes. And then they started building the pipeline once they had things.
Well, the state of Alaska took a while to get mature enough to get enough equipment up there. But in the meantime, ARCO and BP were flying their own equipment in or using Tennessee Miller. He'd haul stuff up there in his CAT train.
Right. Well, and it is true that the pipeline and the road got delayed because of the native land claims.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to wait for all that. But then once they got that settled, they started building from Pluto south?
Yeah, they started building both directions.
Oh, from Fairbanks and Pluto, mm-hmm. They met in the railroad across the United States.
Like the Alaska Highway.
Yeah.
On both ends. Logical thing to do.
Mm-hmm. So did you write stories about the construction of the pipeline?
Yeah. Mostly pictures. But there were daily reports. You know, they laid the next, what were those lengths, 50-foot lengths would be?
I don't know.
48-inch, about 50 feet.
50 feet of pipe.
Yeah, I think it was about 50 feet. I'm not sure how long each section was.
Right.
Each piece of pipe was.
And they had to weld them together.
Oh, yeah, it was slow going. Yeah, they had to be very careful there. Because those welds had to last for 50 years.
Yeah.
And or more.
In some places they buried it, in some places they mm-hmm. built all those structures.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an amazing feat of engineering.
Yeah, it is. Really, I love to go up there and look at that. You know, you drive up through Adigan Pass mm-hmm. and see the engineering they had to do up there. It was remarkable.
Yeah, I'm always amazed at that view up at Adigan, looking north, out across the tundra.
Yeah, and that road going down like that.
The twisty road and the pipeline snaking along.
Yeah, it's an amazing sight.
It's amazing that they were able to do that.
There's a peak, when you get up in Attica and just start down, you can look over your left shoulder. There's a peak there named after James Dalton.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, most people don't.
No, that's funny.
USGS did that.
Oh, that's good.
They didn't ask anybody, they just did it.
That's good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm getting tired.
Okay, well, that's a good place to stop then. And the next time we'll maybe do more News Minor experiences or something else, whatever you come up
with.
Well,
I'm not sure how I got back to town on that trip. But one time I was up there and I hitched a ride with Don Johns.
Who's that?
He was the pilot who flew Begich into the ground.
Oh.
Nick Begich.
Right.
In 1972.
So what was that flight like?
Harrowing. Have you flown through Anaktuvik?
Yes.
Well, you know how the peaks are like this?
The pointy, yeah.
He was in a hot rod plane. He was a pilot jockey.
Mm-hmm.
Took a lot of chances. Anyway, I don't know if it was that time, but I rode south with him one time because it was the only plane I could find going south that had room and would take me. We went through the Brooks Range, and he just gave us an exciting trip through the Brooks Range, like just through all the peaks.
Like zigzagging through all the
passes. Tourist trip, yeah.
Oh.
And most of us have been up there, you know, a long time, had gone over the Brooks Range quite a few times. But now I understand why Nick Begich was lost.
Yeah.
He was taking chances that night. The night they went down, it was a bad icing night for flights.
Yeah. So the flight you were on was coming from Dead Horse or from Anaktuvik?
I think it was coming from Anaktuvik. I flew from Anaktuvik back to Fairbanks, and I flew with different people different times.
Right.
And I don't know if that was the time I flew with Don Johns or not, but I flew with him one time, yeah. And that was enough.
Right. Yeah, it sounds pretty exciting.
Hmm?
It's pretty exciting flying in and out of Anaktuvik under the best.
With anybody, with the best of us.
Yeah.
And he was a jockey. Hot shot jockey.
Pilot cowboy.
Hmm?
A pilot cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
Or cowboy pilot, I guess.
He was a colorful person, but he took too many chances. He killed our congressman.
Yeah. Well, he killed himself in that mm-hmm. flight, too, yeah.
Well, he killed four people.
Well, there were four?
Hale Boggs, wasn't he? The,
yeah, Hale Boggs and Nick Begich.
Speaker of the House.
Speaker of the House.
Yeah. It was Begich, Boggs, and the pilot. Was there somebody else?
Yes, there was a person named Brown who was Begich's aide.
Oh, I never knew that.
So it killed Don Johns and Begich and Hale Boggs and
Brown.
And Begich's aide, something Brown.
Yeah, well, back in that day, there were a lot of characters. Bush pilots took a lot of risks. When they say there are old pilots and bold pilots, but no old bold pilots.
Mm-hmm. Didn't say that.
Yeah, and that time, those early days, it was even more so. So. Well, shall we stop for today and we can do more?
Yes.
Okay. Very good.